Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today's episode is a consequence of a whole bunch of comments that we received on one of our latest YouTube episodes regarding playing time. Should playing time be equally distributed or should it not? And under what conditions should it or should it not be distributed in a certain manner? There seems to be a lot of controversy over this over the past decade or so here in the United States, where there is a predominant mainstream narrative going around, or has been going around, that everybody should play and we should have this sort of egalitarian sort of youth soccer ecosystem, which of course is for the most part nonsensical. So we dive a little bit deep into the nuances of certain contexts in this episode, along with, and something that's highly correlated, is with respect to yelling on the sidelines. Should coaches, quote unquote, yell on the sidelines? What does yelling even mean? When is it good? When is it bad? So once more, the context is very important, and we discuss it together. Benny joins me, of course. And just a little reminder, if you're catching the episodes on YouTube, that's awesome. If you're not, and if you're not aware, we are on YouTube. These episodes are there. You get to see our face. You get to see our body language. You get to see whether things are authentic or not. Wink, wink. Hint, hint. So I would encourage you to head on over to YouTube and subscribe to the channel. And of course, we're being very responsive to the comments there. So if you have any sort of follow-ups, that's a good place to do so. Or you can, of course, always email me at gary@343.com if things are a little bit more sensitive and you don't want to be public with it. And for those of you who are coaches, I would strongly encourage you to go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium products for you there to hop on to a methodology that literally pioneered and revolutionized the development of youth teams and youth players here in our country. Of course, the practitioner there under the microscope is Brian Kleiben. He is a pioneer who spearheaded this revolution. You get to see and hear him in the actual training environment, his training environment with his actual teams, his actual players, as he goes through the art and the methodology and the philosophy of development. Parents, it's important for you to develop as well. So if you want to develop your level of discernment about what is good and what is bad and what is in between here in American soccer, you should go to 343masterclass.com. This is a new program, a relatively new program that launched just over a year ago, and it compiles and compresses and codifies our decades worth of experience and expertise in this realm. It's pretty rough out there. I'm sure you've taken your beatings with your kid in the youth soccer scene here in the States. So just like with coaches, I would highly encourage you to head on over to 343masterclass.com and sign up to the program there. Finally, coaches who are coaching the little ones in the 7-versus-7 format, 7v7coaching.com is the place for you. All right, here we go with Benny Rogers, and we're talking playing time alongside yelling from the sidelines. I hope you enjoy. Here we go.
So let's get into it. Again, a lot of really good comments. I wanted to start with one. I think maybe there was a misconception in terms of, you know, we mentioned before, right, that, or you mentioned that you were against, you know, equal playing time for all the kids. And I think some people, you know, took that, like, even at the youngest ages, meaning when they're like 5 years old or 6 years old and they're still playing 4v4. So one of the comments was from Nicholas Gosselin. He says, "Hey, Gary and Ben, I just wanted some clarity. Regardless of the parents paying, do you think there is an age and or level that the standard should be to have equal playing time, or are you against it regardless?"
Yeah, so definitely not against it regardless. I think what we were mostly talking about, Ben, was the competitive levels, first and foremost. And then, you know, there's a gradation. So I'll be very clear. If you're talking about the little kids, you're talking about 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, even 10-year-olds, but the 10-year-olds might be complete wreck scenario where you just want to go outside, have the kids have an experience and have some mobility, you know, get some fresh air, smell the grass, that sort of stuff. Spread the love, spread the playing time all over the place, okay? As the kids get older and older, then I think that that equality should start being, you know, not being so charitable anymore. It should be more earned from a sporting perspective. What age specifically? I can't give you a specific age. That has to be in the judgment of the club, in the judgment of the coach, and frankly, in the judgment of the parent. If that's what they're looking for, meaning equal playing time, then the competitive circuits aren't necessarily for them. You know, so what specific age? I don't know, Benny. I mean, coming off of my experience, things can get quite competitive already at U11. You know, so talking about 10-year-olds, all right, let's start building in a meritocracy here, you know, and start training them in that sort of manner. But that would be at the highly competitive levels at U11. Maybe if it's still a rec team or a mid team at U11, maybe you're not doing that quite yet. Now, it also is a function of, like I just hinted at, level of play. So I don't know. That's the age thing and then the level of play. Those are the two ingredients, guys. So spread the love when they're tiny little kids and then build in the meritocracy as they get older.
And I think even if you have a player that's maybe hasn't started playing, maybe they started when they're like 11 or 12, like you don't have to go and join a club team, right? Find a signature team, find a rec team. And I think at those levels, the playing time should be shared, you know, equally, because at that point it's like, this isn't club. This isn't obviously you still want to be competitive, right? But it's not this like feeling of need to win every game or every tournament. I think the pressure for playing time happens more in the club scene or club environment, you know? I've had players on my teams in the past where, you know, again, we talk about this bottom 25% of the roster, and I had the honest conversation with the parent. I'm like, look, they're 9 years old, they're 10 years old. Even if they aren't getting the playing time here, like, sign up for a signature team, you know, get some extra minutes on the weekend. And I think at those levels is where they can develop more and have a chance to play more. I don't think there's any coaches out there that are signature and rec that, you know, don't play a kid for the entire game. Do you?
No, I completely agree, Ben. Look, and what you just described could be at U14 also. So 13-year-old kids, just go and play a shit ton of minutes, 100%. And maybe that type of program, that type of team, that is what that kid wants. That is what the parent wants. It's very simple. Are we in a rec program or are we in a competitive program? That's all. That's all it is. And the distinguishing factor also that I'm throwing in there is that maybe there shouldn't be a quote unquote competitive program when the kids are really small. You know, I'm just saying that maybe at U11 is when the real competition kind of starts, and then you have to make a decision. But again, to reemphasize, you could be a 13-year-old playing U14 and it's a rec or signature sort of program. Yeah, play there, man. No problem at all. Would you say that maybe the question that they're angling for here is equal playing time, even though it's a competitive club team? You know what I mean? Because maybe they're asking that question. And if that's the case, then I don't agree that there should be equal playing time if it is legit a competitive club team.
Well, they did mention in their comment, you know, regardless of the parents' pain. So you can only assume that they're talking about a club environment where the parents are probably paying like $2,000, $3,000.
Okay. So then it just becomes exclusively an age and then philosophy question. Because I'll tell you my personal opinion. If I were coaching, me, myself, if I were coaching, let's say a U11 team, and the level is not at the top, 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 top level, okay? It's in the middle. And the parents are playing, then I spread the love around. I'm not going to go hardcore meritocracy at all. Now, if it's a U11 team and it is top, 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 top flight, top, top level, then yes, there's going to be some injection of a meritocracy. And no, I don't mean the extreme case of kids don't play, period. Not at all. Not at all. I'm saying, hey, there's going to be situations where the kid plays 25% of the game instead of 50, or 30% of the game instead of 50. But I'm talking top level. Then,
and something too that parents have to understand, and this is especially, I'm learning this as a high school coach, it's like at the varsity level, not everybody plays. There's been players on the team this year that have literally haven't gone in the entire season. And I think parents think that at the younger ages, my kid was, even if they're not playing every game, maybe they got in for like 5 minutes. But at when they get to this point of high school or and even college, like playing time is not guaranteed, you know? So it's a big wake up call for a lot of families, even if they are the star on their team, it's not the same at the next one.
Totally. Totally. And again, the opposition would say, yeah, but Benny, you're talking about 13, 14, 17 year olds at that point, you know, and Gary, what you're talking about 11 year olds. And there is a difference there. Of course, there's a difference. That's why I said that every kid would be playing on my team. It just wouldn't be a 50-50 split either. And look, it's not like coaches out there are some heartless, hard-nosed, oh, I'm going to live vicariously through the kids. And, you know, maybe I don't have power in my real life or my real world job, you know, and I'm going to deploy my authority and power here and get my rocks off like that. I don't think coaches are really like that for the most part. I think most coaches are out there are trying to do what is best, not only for the entire team, the club, but also for every player. So they will look for situations. I think they're looking for every possible situation to have the bottom 25% of the roster participate as much as possible. I think every coach is trying to do that. So for instance, if you know that on the coming weekend, you are going to face a very weak opponent or opponent that you should be able to handle without an issue, I'm sure most coaches out there will look at the bottom 25% of their roster and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to start Johnny and I'm going to start Mike this game. You know, and try to have them play the entire game. And in fact, I am not going to play my star player, my top 25% of the roster that much. That happens, Ben. I know because I've lived it. I know because that is what we used to do as well. But again, it just escalates from the ages, right? At U12, then at U13, then at U15, then U17, obviously it's kind of pure meritocracy.
Yeah. This is probably going to sound wild to you, Gary, but even in those games where you're playing like a lower level team and you know you're going to play your subs, sometimes you'll still hear complaints from the parents saying like, oh, Johnny's only playing today because we're playing this team, you know? So
right.
They can never be happy, Gary. And right. Like, I mean, you know this, it's always the coach's fault. When the kid's not playing, the coach is an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. He should be putting this player there. It's, The blame always gets put on the coaches. I feel like coaches are demonized a lot of the time.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks. And I've heard that many times too. Yeah, oh, Johnny's only playing because we're playing the last place team or we're playing some lower level team. Well, yes, we want him to get playing time and have experience. And isn't that what you want? Well, what are we talking about? Like, don't look at it as some sort of insult. I mean, I think the parents know, hey, my kid's in the bottom 25% of the roster. So do you want us to be consistent and continue and say, you know what? Nah, even though we know we've got this game handled, nah, we're not going to play him anyway. What? What are we talking about?
Right. Yeah. Would you rather Johnny not play again? Here's the thing though. Johnny loves playing in that game because this fool probably gets a goal, his only goal the whole season. Yeah. And that's what sparks him to keep going.
Totally. And it's also another opportunity to also demonstrate to his teammates and to the coach and to everybody, hey, man, I can handle my own. I can do my business here. You can trust me.
1000%, Gary. Taylor, 2470, she had a couple good comments for us. The first one, thoughts on guest playing, Gary. When is it appropriate? How should it be done? She says, I think in general, guest playing is about winning and inflates how good or developed a team is. It is often playing down levels for the players versus called up, which is maybe valuable, but also maybe lacks a culture of improving the play up too, right? You want me to read that again?
So I'm not sure what they mean by that. No, I'm not sure what they mean by that second part. Maybe you'll be able to handle that part of the question. My thoughts, generally speaking, on guest playing is, I'll tell you how kind of we would use it. And I think what they're talking about is guest playing from outside the club, right? Bringing in guest players that are not part of the club, or is it guest players from within internally the club? Those are two separate things. So I'm just going to tell you about outside of the club. We would bring in guest players from outside the club when we're trying to recruit those said players, because I want them to understand the culture of our team, feel, you know, get warm with our teammates and have our teammates get warm with the potential recruit. I want them to feel the success of being on this team. And so that is mostly why we would use guest players in the past. And is it about winning? Well, guess what? If we want to recruit somebody, it's because it's going to make our team stronger. So actually the probability of us winning when we have a guest player goes up for sure. We usually don't bring in a guest player who is going to lower the level of the team. And so is it about winning? Yeah, it's about winning also, but let's not forget that winning enables the development process. Winning enables the coach, affords the coach a longer runway to operate and do their training sessions and their methodology in peace, because you don't have the club all over your back. You don't have the most of the parents all over your back when the team is winning. And also the top 50 and the top 75% of the roster on your team is going to improve and get better and better and better the higher the level of the team is. So if you can bring in guest players that elevates the level of the team, 75% of the roster benefits from it. The people who do not generally benefit from it, again, is unfortunately the bottom 25% of the roster, because probability is that they're going to have even more reduced playing time, and they're going to feel, the parents principally, but of course the players will feel it to some degree as well. They're going to feel more and more kind of excluded from the process. So, I mean, what's the solution? I suppose the solution is no guest player ever, so that bottom 25% never feels anything. But then in my opinion, you're doing a huge disservice to the other 50%, 75% of the roster whose parents and players want to continue developing and going up the curve. So I guess in the end, my judgment would be that I don't oppose guest playing, but that's just from one perspective, which is the perspective I just laid out. I'm sure there's all kinds of nuances and angles, which is kind of why we wanted to bring Jonathan Prieto on, because he said, hey, this guest playing stuff is BS, is bullshit, because maybe he's looking at it from a perspective of a coach who goes to maybe tournaments or wherever, and he takes his team as it is, and then all the other teams have guest players, and so he gets run over, you know, by the other teams who have guest players. So I don't know.
Yeah, I can remember as a player on Brian's team, you know, well, you guys would use guest players to try and recruit these kids to actually join the team, right? But anytime there was a guest player or somebody that Brian's trying to sign, it was always like, hey, let's make them feel part of the team. And I think today, like with Prieto's frustrations, is exactly what you said. Like, I think coaches will just grab a guest player so that they can win a big tournament. And then even if they have no chance of signing this kid, like let's say he's locked in with the team for a whole year, they'll still, you know, invite him to guest play. They win the tournament. And then all of a sudden parents see that they're winning tournaments and more people want to go to that team. Or for example, right, I was in State Cup a couple of weeks ago, and I've told you before, my team is, you know, at the lowest of levels in that State Cup. And you can see on the other team's roster, like they are pulling down kids from the higher teams. So for example, we were playing in flight 3, and you see that the club is pulling down flight 1 players to play with the flight 3 team. And it's just, my team is getting run over because there's 2 or 3 kids that are just bossing the game. So I think that's where the frustration comes from a lot of parents and coaches as well, is just people trying not even to recruit them to their team, but just to win. Just to be trophy hunters, just to show the parents, like, oh, look at me. I'm, you know, I just won Surf Cup, or I just won State Cup with players that weren't even my own, you know. But for the parents, they don't care. It's like, oh, like Johnny didn't even make, or not Johnny, because we said that Johnny sucks, but, you know, Henry guest played with us and we won, but it didn't matter because my son still balled out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, what you just described is a completely different angle than what I finished ranting on. But yeah, I understand. So yeah. In that respect, what do I feel about what your situation that you laid out? I don't like it. I don't like it, because what is the ultimate objective there? I just described what our ultimate objective was. Our ultimate objective is to recruit somebody, make them feel loved, make the families of the top 75% of the team, you know, give them a signal, hey, we're working on improving the collective, you know, and strengthening the team, and et cetera, et cetera. But that's not what you described, man. So again, this is unfortunately the American soccer ecosystem we're all living under. It's a toxic one, and it's toxic because of that bad word of promotion relegation not existing.
Yeah. And so in the second part of her question, I think she was kind of referring to what I mentioned, where like a flight one player will play down with a flight three team. And she's saying the opposite doesn't exist, where they're bringing up a flight three player to play with flight two. And she says, is this a lack of culture of improving to play up? Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it's quite straightforward, quite honestly. It's simply that, again, the youth soccer ecosystem here is all about winning senseless things, because that's the only signal that can be transmitted to the marketplace is the win-loss column. Because who are the customers? The parents are the customers. And what do the parents want to principally do is have their kid on the highest, most winningest team possible that they can play on. And you have to win games to do that. You know, and the clubs want to win games because that helps their brand or their prestige, and that helps with player retention, customer retention, and it helps with customer recruitment. And so if a club says, hey, you know what, if we drop all our top flight teams to lower flight teams so that we can win these lower level tournaments, at least we can maybe snag some parents, some more customers, because, oh, look, Club X won this tournament. We should go to Club X. Ben, I mean, I don't know what else there is to say about it, man. That's the nature of the beast here. The nature of the beast here has absolutely nothing to do with developing footballers and optimizing the development of players. It has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like Brian was kind of a pioneer in actually playing his entire team up like 2 years or 3 years in. Frankly, you don't really see that anymore these days. It's more the opposite, where you see players knocking down to go and trophy hunt.
Yeah, yeah. Though we can add that little tidbit too, because I have been out of touch with the youth scene for a while, ever since I started working with the professionals. Yeah, Brian did so many unprecedented things, and that's one of them. He not only would have some of the better players play up in age or play up 2 years in age, he would actually enter his entire team or teams to play up an entire age group in the most prestigious tournaments or in the leagues, and sometimes 2 years up. And no, you end up not winning, especially if like they're 12 years old and you're going to play 2 years up in a U14 tournament. Imagine the difference in human physiology between a 12 and a 14 year old. And it would be very competitive, close, tight game. Sometimes he would win, sometimes he would lose by a goal or something, but you don't end up winning the tournament, but that wasn't the goal. And of course, the parents, however, were educated and were all on board with it. And they knew going into this tournament, playing with young kind of kids that were entering puberty at that point, that we weren't going to win the tournament. So yeah, it was the opposite. It was the opposite of trophy hunting, Benny. He didn't choose to play his own age and then just crush everybody. He's like, you know what? No, that doesn't help us. Let's play up. Let us get crushed. And then the kids get exposed for their deficiencies. So you're saying you don't see it anymore?
No, I haven't seen it personally. Maybe there's people out there or maybe there are coaches who out there who do that, or they have a top level team and they're playing up 1 year in a tournament. But even if that does happen, Gary, let's say it's a flight one 2015 team. They will play up in the 2014 bracket, but in the flight three bracket. You know what I'm saying? Not against the top flight one 2014. So that is what you do see nowadays. Not like, hey, let's play my team a year up and we're still going to compete events against the best, 2014s. You don't see that these days.
Got it. I don't blame people. They're scared. The coaches are scared, or whoever's entering, you're scared. You're scared of getting so exposed that it causes chaos in the roster. But okay. All right, man. Do you think we kind of answered the question or no?
Yeah, 1000%. Another good one from her touches on yelling at players by coaches. I've been dealing with our coach yelling things at the team that are not coaching cues, but more along the lines of negative put downs. Or maybe just over-the-top emphasis on mistakes. They are 7-year-old girls. The tone is angry and it's loud. Wake up or I'm taking you out, and quit failing. I struggled with, I want her to be challenged and coached and developed and held to a standard, but I also want a culture of fun and enjoyment and love of the game. I can see my daughter mentally afraid to make mistakes versus free and empowered to make plays. When and how should coaches yell? Should they adjust their style to each player? Should I get my daughter off the team, even though it's the top team, so she doesn't lose her love for the game with that environment?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. That is a full episode unto itself, because there's so many nooks and crannies and rabbit holes to go down, because the context matters a lot. And because, as this person hinted at, it also depends on the individual player, right? As to what buttons to push and what buttons not to push, and how to bring them along a development path with respect to how much to push them, you know, and how much not to push them. But generally speaking, I heard 7-year-olds. That's ridiculous. He shouldn't be yelling at 7-year-olds. That's the dumbest thing in the world. So number one, red flag, really bad situation already. Negatively put downs, that's even worse. You know, yelling's already kind of bad at that age, but if it's negative put downs, even worse. Like, that's ridiculous. And then the natural question is, okay, well, at what age, Gary? Because obviously that will be the comment on this episode, Benny. Just like the playing time thing, it depends. I can't tell you a specific age. I'll tell you from my experience at the U11 level, 10 and 11 year olds, at the peak of the pyramid, Benny, is where we were operating. Hey, can you yell from the sidelines and give instructions and things that are helpful? Absolutely. Should it be negative? No, it should not be negative. It should be with a positive intonation, a positive posture, almost like no exceptions, Ben, at that level. But look at the context I'm giving you. The top of the food, the best team in the whole bloody country, Benny, by a mile, and 10, 11-year-olds, not 7-year-old girls. And I presume this is more of a rec situation. So should you move on? I mean, I always want to be careful with giving advice, because I'm not there to see exactly what's going on. But taking the words at face value, yeah, you should move on. Like, what are we even doing here? Get the kid out of there. Go to a place where they're going to fully enjoy their experience. And look, when they do get to the age or the level where, quote unquote, yelling from the sidelines is okay or more acceptable, it's challenging, because it takes a very special coach to be able to do that in a way that the players and the families feel to their bones that it has zero malice and zero bad intent with the yelling. It takes a very special coach for the player to receive that stuff while they're on the field and know that it comes from a place of pure love and a pure heart intent, you know, to develop the player and to develop the team and help the team and help the players. Not many coaches have that, in my opinion. And I think obviously that is developed on a one-on-one and one-to-many relationship on the training grounds in practice and throughout the course of weeks and months and potentially years of that relationship being fostered with the player and the family. So all of that has to come together so that yelling on the sidelines, in my opinion, is acceptable. Now, if we're talking about U15, U17 levels, then the specialness of the coach doesn't have to be that remarkable for it to be also be okay to be yelling out instructions from the sideline.
Yeah, Gary, I think what you said about coming from a place of love is huge. And, you know, the coach really has to have a good rapport with all the players. Otherwise, you know, the players are going to take it negatively. And, you know, I know I always bring up like my time with Brian Singh, but I think it's valuable because, you know, at that age, I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. And that's one of the things that Brian like does an amazing job of, is showing love to all his players, not just like at training, but you know, off the field. And he makes you feel like he really does care about you. And so in the game, when he's yelling at me to, you know, wake my ass up or, you know, let's go, it didn't seem like, oh, Brian's a dick or what's wrong with this guy. I was like, no, all right. Like, this guy cares about me. He's telling me I need to wake up, and he's right. You know, so if the coach doesn't have that rapport with the player, then that's when it can turn into a negative thing, especially if they're a seven-year-old girl. You know, I mean, you know, I don't want to be sexist here, but, you know, girls are a little bit more sensitive when it comes to getting yelled at. You know, I think if a 7-year-old boy gets yelled at by the coaches, the kid's probably like, oh, like, you know, screw you. But for a girl, like, maybe, I don't know. Am I sexist in saying that she might get her feelings?
I don't think so. And I think it's fine for everybody to admit that there are differences. Okay. You know, Brian also had a girls team for a couple seasons, as you well know, Benny, and also had a remarkable run with that girls team, bringing them up through the ranks and making them extremely competitive at the top level of the girls youth system, with two girls going on to University of North Carolina and winning national championships with Youth North Carolina. And one of them even going off and playing professional soccer for a while. You know, people can do their homework if they like. And with that team, you know, I participated and put in my hours as well, kind of like with that Rage team, because it was quite remarkable what he was doing there too. I mean, up until that point, he had proven what can be done on the boys' side. And now he was proving it on the girls' side, and it was never seen before. So I'm like, oh, I'm kind of interested. I'm going to go check this out. And my experience, Ben, was it is different how girls receive information and execute on information. And frankly speaking, I think Brian would agree with me. I don't know what your perspective was, Ben. The girls are able to listen and execute better than the boys. Better, Benny. They kind of assimilate the information as it's intended, and then are able to follow instructions way better. It was quite interesting. On the flip side, you know, there is more of a sensitivity as to how you deliver that message, you know, because I could be yelling instructions or being quite direct and brash with the boys, the guys, and they kind of receive it a certain way. And if I were to do it in the same tone to the girls, there is a bigger sensitivity there. And, you know, it's tougher. So you have to be a little bit softer, in my opinion, when you're harsh, when you're quote unquote harsh with the girls, when you want to give them tough love, it has to be delivered differently.
Yeah. I've had experience coaching both boys and girls at, you know, U8, U9. And the analogy that I like to use for the girls is like, they're kind of like little soldiers, meaning like anything that you tell them, they're going to respond to, and they follow instructions really well. But like you just said, Gary, you do have to be careful in how you deliver that message, because girls will easily turn against you if they perceive, you know, like a threat, or they perceive that, you know, you have malintentions. Whereas if, like you said, with the boys, you can be harsh and, you know, critical of them, and they kind of just shrug it off. And it's like, all right, well, this fool just said that to me. All right, no problem. But with the girls, they will turn on you if you've taken it too far, or if, you know, even if you say the wrong thing. But I just think, Gary, like, some coaches just take it way too far in the way that they're yelling, or like, it's unbelievable that I even have to say this, but I came across a coach who shall not be named at a club, who shall not be named, but literally, Gary, in the middle of games, like if a player would make a mistake, and this is a girls team, Gary, maybe like 8 years old, one of the kids made a mistake or like wasn't listening, this would have the entire team do a push-up in the middle of the game. He's like, everybody down. They'd all get down for a push-up. Meanwhile, the other team is like on a counterattack. It's like, what are we doing here? Some coaches just take it to like the next extreme. And I bet you people listening to this probably know that coach, because this story has been told many times.
Jesus, Benny. You know what comes to mind there, aside from all the classic views of why that coach would be doing something like that? What comes to my mind is that particular coach, or coaches like that, don't have a methodology, a training methodology. They don't have an overall philosophy rooted in how to develop teams and players. They don't have that, you know, and so they're inventing things as they go along. They have an idea, and they're like, ooh, what if, you know, one player makes a mistake, everybody, you know, suffers the consequences from it, and I'm going to make them all do a push-up. Like, they're inventing a methodology out of thin air, out of nothing. Maybe they saw a movie, they saw, you know, Full Metal Jacket or something, and they saw how the drill sergeant made the whole platoon, you know, suffer and do training exercises out in the snow because one guy ate an extra donut or something. He's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to deploy that with my 7-year-old girl team. That is what comes to my mind, Ben. They're not educated in coaching.
Yeah. Do you think it's also like a cultural thing, Gary? Because oftentimes you'll see international coaches who have come over to the U.S. and are coaching youth teams. You do notice that they are a little bit more intense and just in the way that they speak to the team, or, you know, the way that they're not so much yelling at the players, but it just seems a little bit more aggressive. Is this a cultural thing? Do you think this type of coaching happens at the youth levels abroad and overseas?
It's a massive cultural thing, Ben, as to the level of intensity and the way you speak to players. It varies from culture to culture, no question about it. My mind goes straight to Uruguay again. There's something called Bobby football or baby football there. It's kind of infamous. And if folks out there listening aren't aware of it, maybe just Google search baby football Uruguay, and you'll see basically, I don't know what they play, if it's 3v3, 4v4, 5, whatever it is, but little kids, I'm talking about 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, and they're put like in an indoor rink, yeah, like a cage, and with two goals, and they go at it, but they're kicking the shit out of each other, and the parents and everybody on the sidelines are all for it. So it's kind of like UFC coupled with soccer, coupled with 4 and 5-year-old kids and a soccer ball. So it's hardcore in that regard. And, you know, after the World Cup, or the Copa America, rather, the last one, the men's one, where Argentina beat Colombia, there was a lot of interviews with former Colombian national team players and even former ones and coaches. And they're asking, hey, what was the difference between Argentina and Colombia? Like, I don't understand. We had a better team than Argentina, which was true. Colombia stacked, way better team, pound for pound. Like, how are we losing these games? It doesn't make any sense to us. And all these former professional Colombian national team players, they all would say the same thing. Look, growing up, we were kind of okay and coddled with losing, you know, our culture and our parents and our clubs are like, oh, it's okay, we'll get them next time and it's fine. And in Argentina, they would cite from their own personal experience, because many of them played in Argentina. They played for Boca or River or Vélez Sarsfield or Independiente or whatever. And in Argentina, growing up as a kid and in their professional teams and everything, it's win at all costs, no matter what, you know, and losing is a travesty. It is traumatic to lose. You know, they inject trauma into the kids of losing. You know, if a team made a whole tournament and they blew by everybody and lost in the final and come in second place, the kids who are in second place, they're tortured. You know, they don't look back and they're like, oh, we did good. You know, we got all the way to the final. We almost had them. That's not the culture. And so, I don't know, long-winded answer to say, yes, it's culture dependent. You know, do we need more of that here? I would say, yes, we do. Do we need that coach who does 7-year-old girl push-ups because one messed up? No, we don't need that. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, definitely, Gary. I got to witness a couple of weeks ago, you know, and this is no shade to them, but there's this Armenian club, and they've actually had to jump around under like different clubs because of like suspensions and stuff like that. But like, long story short, I witnessed the coach of that team and also the parents, like, Gary, the most intense yelling at the players, you know, in their language, right? And so I didn't know what they were saying, but like, intense screaming, like one of the kids, you know, gets injured and the coach is yelling at him to, like, you know, get up. And after the game, I'm pretty sure that, Gary, they tied the game or they won the game, and the coach is still like just ripping into them. But you can also see, like, these kids are tough kids and they can take it, you know. And just noticing that, you also notice how the kids also have like a little bit more of a competitive edge in the games, meaning like they want to win and they're going to do everything that they can. But I'm telling you, Gary, it was wild, like the most intense yelling I've ever seen, like full metal jacket times 20.
And look, somewhere in the middle is like the Mexicans and the Mexican leagues here, at least in Southern California, the culture of those types of games. Yeah. All the parents on the sidelines, not just the coach, are yelling at the kids, you know, and is it good? Is it bad? See, we have these sorts of discussions. What I can't tell you for sure, because I don't want this podcast episode to be misinterpreted, the suburban American soccer culture, the way they do soccer is soft as fucking Charmin. Okay. It's not, that is not, it's also not good at all. It is making players extremely soft, extremely fragile. There's no resilience to them. There's no toughness to them. There's no competitiveness to them. It's weakening them, not just for soccer, I think for life, frankly speaking, the way that the suburban American mainstream youth soccer and pro soccer culture comports itself. So should it be all about, oh, if Mary is picking a daisy on the, you know, and the game's going on, that's ridiculous also. We can't have that. Let's have some sort of competitive fire in us as well. It just has to be done the right way, Ben. So some sort of mixture, and the relationship between the coach and the families is critical.
I'm sure you heard a lot of stories of, you know, especially in the Latino culture, of after the games, like the dads ripping into their kids saying, you had a shocking performance today. You know, what's wrong with you? Like, I never seen you play like this. Like, you're a disgrace to the family, you know?
And look, can it turn a kid off from the sport or the game or whatever? Sure, it can. It's possible. But that's also culture. It depends. Because maybe if you're ripping into a soft kid, one that has been raised for 7 or 10 or 12 years as being super soft, and you start all of a sudden, you change the way that you behave with them and you start ripping into them, that player is more susceptible and likely to shut off and turn off and quit and those sorts of things. You understand what I'm saying? But if you've been talking to the kid and being strict like this since they opened their eyes in this world, okay? And then you talk to them like that when they're 11, 12, 13, that kid is more resilient, Benny. And they won't shut off and say, you know what? Fuck this. Soccer's not for me. I hate soccer. I hate the sport. I hate my parents. I hate the coach. They don't shut off. So, because I hear this all the time, Benny. Oh, well, you can't say those sorts of things because it'll turn the kid off. It's just bad, you know? Well, yeah, if the kid's been soft their whole life, it probably is bad. But if the kid has some sort of anti-fragility to him, it's not bad.
Right. I don't want to go down the entire rabbit hole of sideline coaching, Gary, but do you think it helps or hinders the kid to hear? Again, I'm not talking about sideline coaching, but like from a parent, like ripping into the kid from the sideline, like, what are you doing? Or, you know, wake up, or, you know, work harder. That help, or does it hinder the kid?
It depends. It's an art from the coach's perspective. It's an art, because if it's a very young age group, I would say, and the parent is very knowledgeable and fully on board with what the team is trying to do and the coach is trying to do, it could potentially be helpful. I'm just giving you the one exception to the rule. And the rule is, generally speaking, it is not helpful, because generally speaking, first off, it should be one voice only from the sideline. And that is the coach or the coaching staff's voice, nobody else. Number two, generally speaking, the parent does not know the game or football or the methodology that's being deployed or what the objectives of this particular game may or may not be. From the coach or for the coach. They don't know. They don't understand all of those sorts of things. Even if they are super knowledgeable, Ben, the parent, they may not know that the coach and the technical staff for this particular game is choosing to do something that might be different than what they've been doing. So the parent shouldn't be speaking from the sideline. And yeah, from the player's perspective, it just leads to confusion, because now you have two authorities. You know, the coach, which is an authority, and then the parent, which is an authority for that particular player. And it leads to confusion, and then they're not having any fun.
Yeah, you see it a lot, Gary. And I don't want to single out dads. Maybe there's some moms out here that do this too, but more oftentimes you see it with the dads. It's like a kid will be on the field and he'll make a mistake, and immediately his first reaction is to look at his dad to see how he's responding. Or he makes a good pass and he checks over to see if, you know, his dad is clapping for him. So I think there's a line that you have to be careful not to cross of doing too much as a parent, because then if the kid depended on you for the first 10 years of his development, like it's going to be shocking by the time he gets to 16, 17, 18. And he's so dependent on having that, you know, figure there to look over and support him. Then I just don't think they'll be ready for whatever next level that they're going to.
Yeah, agreed, Ben. Agreed. Did we satisfy this question? I forget. We go off on these rants. I don't even know what the question is anymore.
Yeah, I think this one was in terms of, you know, yelling at the players, but I think 1,000% we satisfied. I want to give you a little time, Gary, because I know you're going to have a lot of thoughts on this particular comment, and you actually responded to him as well. But Gustavo Lazio, thank you, Gary and Benny, for tackling on the real issues that we face in the U.S. club environment. It all trickles down from a closed system and no promotion relegation at the pro level. Please keep these episodes coming. But what I wanted to bring up is your comment back to him. You say that too many have been brainwashed by MLS propagandists masquerading as journalists. Key to turning this whole thing around is supporting truly independent voices. Word of caution, many have been masquerading as independents when in fact they are grifting just like these journalists. So what did you mean by that, Gary?
Exactly what
I wrote. The world wants to know, yeah.
Exactly what I wrote, Ben. And I think we're, interestingly, public service announcement right now. We're going to discuss a little bit of politics, okay? A little politics is going to be injected in here. So please
tune out. Tune out if you're sensitive.
So please tune out, all of you who have been raised with in a certain way. So we're seeing a lot of it now, right, Ben, with a whole bunch of news outlets being exposed as being funded and editorialized, you know, by arms of, say, the Democratic Party through different channels. And, you know, one might say, oh, well, Gary, you're just buying into some sort of right-wing propaganda because that's how they're defending themselves, right? But look, when you are a practitioner in a certain space for a very long time and you get very good at being a practitioner in a certain space for a very long time, and when you become the subject matter, the topic of the media, or gain the attention of the media, and they start covering you, you start seeing, because you know the truth, right? You know the actual truth of your work and the work in the space, because you're kind of have some expertise in the domain that maybe a reporter or journalist is quote unquote covering. And you clearly can see how, one, they have no knowledge, they have no expertise in the space that they are writing about, number one. And then number two, you can clearly see that there is an agenda behind the narratives that they craft. And then you can clearly see, you just follow the money trail or the power trail. Why are they crafting these sorts of narratives? So, okay, who are their bosses and who are the bosses of their bosses? And so from the American soccer ecosystem perspective, MLS has a monopoly on the top levels of soccer in America. They have a monopoly on it. It is one entity. And so if you are a journalist or a reporter and you want to be a quote unquote mainstream one and make a living off it and have a platform from which, you know, you are given a loud megaphone and be important, well, guess what your incentives are? Your incentives are to please the monopoly. And so you are going to craft and architect narratives that make the monopoly look good and never make the monopoly look bad. And so one of those things, since we're discussing youth soccer here in this episode, MLS is deeply involved in youth soccer also. And even if they weren't deeply involved in youth soccer, who are their paying customers that go to the stadiums, that tune into the TV, or potential customers? They are predominantly the huge youth soccer ecosystem, these families, okay? Particularly the suburban youth soccer families are their target demographic. And so what you are consuming when you read mainstream journalist, mainstream reporter content, be aware that you are being injected with MLS favorable narratives. And they are not going to tell you the things that we discuss in this podcast. So all of your worldviews regarding soccer have been kind of wired through that channel or through those channels. Now, the second part of my comment was, okay, so what do we do, Gary, if we want to know the truth? Or at least we want to know an opposing view, or at least we want to learn alternative narratives to the facts. Okay, you have to look for independent media outlets and independent content creators. In other words, folks who are not subject to the power that is MLS and the influence that is MLS. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be paid by MLS directly. No, FA just means that you don't give a fuck what MLS says or does, because you don't care about their influence. You don't care about their power. You don't care about their money. Your future is not tied to them. So that is what you have to look for, number one. And some folks understand this. And what they do is they position themselves in the marketplace as quote unquote independents by not linking themselves to MLS. So maybe they'll link themselves to the US men's national team and they'll cover just the national team, because obviously that is has a big, huge audience. Or they'll cover maybe the youth soccer landscape, or in one way or another, they're not independent. And one of the simplest acid tests is to see whether they are buddy-buddy with MLS journalists and MLS reporters or MLS content creators. Because what they're doing by being buddy-buddy with them is they're opening up distribution channels for their content. Because if you're buddy-buddy with the MLS guys, well, the MLS guys have been given the biggest distribution by MLS itself. And so if you're buddy-buddy with them, they might share your quote-unquote independent content to their audiences, and then you get bigger. So to be clear, if you're not sure if somebody's independent or not, take a look if they're being buddy-buddy with MLS content creators and MLS reporters or MLS journalists. So who is truly independent? Very few of us, Ben. Very few of us. And I think one of the signals as to who is truly independent is take a look at whose content is not being distributed by MLS-centric outlets. That's a good signal. That's a great signal.
Yeah, I mean, even myself, Gary, like I mentioned in the last episode, this whole narrative of soccer hasn't always been popular in the U.S., you know, and that's a direct result of me being brainwashed by it. Because sometimes you see reporters or you see like interviews and you think that these people are like truly independent and have no ulterior motives. But at the end of the day, it's like they're probably getting paid by some MLS outlet or somebody to push up this narrative to unsuspecting people like me. You know, I'm like, oh, this article looks good. And
yeah,
it seems like this didn't come directly from MLS.
Yeah, yeah, no, they're either directly paid by MLS. So anybody writing for MLSsoccer.com, for example, directly paid by MLS, you can throw that out the window already. If you're not directly working for MLS, well, you're probably working for a media outlet that has a vested interest in the success of MLS. And so that editorial at that outlet is going to be favorable to MLS. It's all going to be pro MLS sort of stuff. And even if you don't work and aren't even making money by creating American soccer content, you might have the aspiration of making money off of it one day in the future, or increase your influence in the future. And so what is the path that most people take? They take the path of kissing the ring and sucking up to those who actually are working for the monopoly in one way or another. So even if you are not getting a single penny in producing soccer content, that doesn't make you independent at all, because they might want to make a penny one day. And even if they don't want to make a penny one day, Benny, they just maybe get their rocks off from being influential or wanting to be influential. And so what do? They cozy up to the monopoly, because that's their best chance. Because what's the alternative? The only alternative, Ben, is being a fucking expert at your craft. And then you could just produce content all day, every day, based on your expertise in the craft. Whether a monopoly likes it or doesn't like it, it doesn't matter. That's the only alternative. Because if you don't have expertise, what are you gonna? You can't create expert level content. You have to write the coattails of the monopoly. That's your only chance, Ben.
Yeah, and so Gary, the only way for this to change is like kind of Elon's quote, where he kind of says like, "We are the media now," right? So it has to come from everybody that tunes in and people that, you know, want to see change in the U.S. Like, we have to become the reporters now. We can't rely on these mainstream narratives to keep getting pushed up. And I think like we're seeing a change in our times where we're allowed to kind of speak out now and say what it is that we really see and how we feel, right? I mean, there's never been a time like this in the history of the world where you can be so free and open to speak your mind.
Yeah. No, 100%, Ben. I think the important thing is to educate folks and expose this truth that I didn't do a great job of unfolding. I'll have to practice unfolding. We'll have to talk about it many more times. But if folks start seeing what this Truman Show is all about, then that tilts the scales. You know, then we'll reach an inflection point. Then, because then we won't pay attention to these mainstream outlets anymore, or these corrupt folks masquerading as journalists. And I don't look, you know how I said, oh, I don't blame them. They have families, they have to feed their families, all that. I get that. I understand all that. But there's an asymmetry here in that if you call yourself or position yourself as a journalist, you're supposed to, you're kind of bound by this code, right? Or this ethical code of telling the truth, the unvarnished truth, truth to power, irrespective of who are the power brokers in the ecosystem. That is what a quote unquote true journalist is supposed to do. And they have thrown that out the window, Ben. They're zero integrity. They don't care whatsoever. And they just lie to the people, Ben. Oh, Gary, they don't lie. Look, read this article from so-and-so or this article from so. Show me the lie. Guys, let's evolve, right? And understand that you can craft narratives from the facts in 100 different ways. So you can get a fact and twist the fact to make it favorable or unfavorable for a particular agenda, and leave out particular facts and cherry pick certain other facts. So you don't have to, quote unquote, blatantly lie, but your narratives lie.
Gary, are there any practitioners that come to mind that, you know, people could follow or tune into, or is there anybody out there that you respect and it's doing good work?
Yeah, look, the closest one to date that I come across is Filippo, that has a handle of tactical manager. You know, I don't follow all of his work. He's a young Brazilian of heritage guy. Probably, I don't know if he's 30 years old. I don't know. Maybe I'll have him on the show at some point. I know he's had Brian on his show in the past. And he kind of fits the bill because he says a lot of things that are inconvenient truths about the monopoly, about U.S. soccer in general. And he kind of passes the acid test. I'd have to revisit his timeline, but I don't see any mainstream guys sharing his content. I don't see any MLS guys sharing his content necessarily, the mainstream ones. And so that's kind of a good signal. And I hope he remains independent. You know, one of my first interactions with him many years ago was, hey man, you're doing great work. I just hope you don't fall prey to so many people who started out doing good work and with great intentions, and then they start feeling the pressure in one way or another from the monopoly to comply to monopoly approved narratives. And that kind of comes in the forms of different sort of incentives. Sometimes they're direct incentives, sometimes they're unspoken incentives. Oh man, you could be 10 times bigger than you are now, buddy, if you would only just fall in line with all of us. And so long as he doesn't go that path, I think that's a good one, Ben. I used to give quite a bit of love to the guys at Soccer America a lot. Those are the old school soccer reporters. They've been in the business for decades, Benny, 30, 40 years, 50 years. And some of the old school guys there, I think, have quite a lot of integrity to them for sure. But I also notice that they do fall in line many a times with monopoly approved narratives and don't go counter to those narratives. So that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate because I think they have a responsibility and they have the influence and the power to not be afraid to go against the narrative. The problem is that with an outlet like that, you know, MLS can pull your credentials or US soccer can pull your media credentials, and all of a sudden you don't really have access to press conferences from the national team coach or press conferences on the MLS side. And that harms people, reporters, journalists, because now you don't have access anymore. So I think I understand why they play it careful. And the other thing that kind of turned me off to a certain degree from the Soccer America guys, even though I still think they're good guys. And I still, of all of the outlets, that's probably the one that is the better one. The other thing that turned me off is they started having a lot of guest writers on their platform. And those guest writers are either complete dunces, number one, or two, are completely compromised by the monopoly, number two. And that turns me off too. I'm like, why are you having these clowns write for such a prestigious platform as Soccer America? So that contaminates the brand and contaminates them.
Yeah, Gary, it's kind of, just thinking about, you know, when you're talking, it's kind of sad for the journalists who do work for MLS and are required to write all these positive things. Like, I don't know how they do it, because they must feel like, well, like, this isn't true, but I'm still going to write this and push it out so I can get my paycheck.
Ben, it's not like that. Well, I'll have to dig up a long form tweet that I shot out maybe a year ago, and I kind of touch on this topic. And I kind of categorize these quote unquote journalists in three categories. There's a real senior guy, the grizzled guy, then there's the mid-career guy, and then there's the newbie. And they don't think that they're doing bad things, Benny. They think they're the good guys. They think they're doing good things. And much like how you had been convinced, thoroughly convinced, that soccer is just not popular here, and that's why soccer doesn't work, or it sucks, or it's so far behind. Just how you were convinced of that, they've been programmed and brainwashed for decades on the narratives, the mainstream narratives. And so that is what they believe down deep in their core of their being about what soccer is and how it is. So when they write their articles or they craft certain narratives, they're doing it because that's what they think is reality, Ben. Most of them.
Yeah,
I would say not most, a lot of them. There are some, however, who are true scumbags who know that they what they're doing, and they go out and smear people and do all this, these hit pieces, true trash of humans. If you know that what you are doing is wrong, and you know that you're lying, and you know, it's just, there are gross ones out there. There are really bad people out there, Ben. I would say borderline evil, if not evil, straight up, because they're impacting people's livelihoods and people's lives straight up, and they don't care.
I mean, their handles, you know, I want to see who you're talking about.
All right, I'll send them to you. Look, and
hey,
I've been, honestly, but do you notice, and I hope people recognize, I think I've been very charitable here, because if you notice, I don't name people's names. I don't want to smear individual humans, even though they deserve it, fully deserve it. I've instead taken the angle of, hey, let me try to level up the education of whoever it is that's listening to us so that they themselves can identify who the clown shows are.
You know what, Gary, I kind of miss the days when you would have like Twitter wars with some of these reporters. Those are hilarious.
Yeah, it's just gross. It makes me feel icky when I engage with scumbags, man. I come to the conclusion it's better to just ignore these people. It doesn't make me a better person when I engage with scumbags. It makes me it's like a cancer, Benny. Like some of their cancerous cells invade your body and darken your soul when you touch them. So it's better to just stay away.
Yeah, it rubs off on you for sure. Hey, Marcelo has officially retired, dude. It's a sad day.
Oh, for real? Okay.
Well,
one of the best outside backs of all time, man. Incredible
player. But you know, I have a feeling that whole generation of players, it's their time is coming to an end, you know. But Marcelo, he's always been my favorite, you know, outside back. I mean, he's just pure class anytime he's on the wall, even at his, you know, 34 or 35. I think he's 36 right now, but even in his last two seasons, he was still showing class. Obviously he slowed down a little bit, but just a phenomenal player.
Yeah, incredible. And I kind of feel like soccer has been eroding for so many years now that the classy players aren't preferred anymore, and they just get pure athletes more and more and more. Like the pure athletes are taking over more and more and more, and the class is disappearing.
Well,
hopefully
Gary,
hopefully Hopefully the pendulum swings the other way someday. I don't know.
Well, Gary, you can respond to this. I mean, you ask anybody right now who's the best left back in the Premier League. What do they say?
Anthony Robinson.
Well, the Jedi.
Oh my God. What a world. What a world.
Hey, somebody also sent a DM on Instagram, and it was like a screenshot of your tweet about like Weston McKennie is fucking terrible and this and that. He's like, hey, repost this now.
Yeah, listen, they conveniently only get a piece of the tweet because it was a chain of tweets. And I was very clear when I said Weston McKennie is shocking. I said he's shocking for a very specific way of playing, a possession-based dominant team. So it was Greg Berhalter's era, and Greg wanted to play possession-based dominant winning team. Weston McKennie is not built for that. That is not Weston McKennie. Is he a starter on Juventus? Is he doing great at one of the best clubs in the world? Absolutely phenomenal. But there's a shit ton of players who do amazing at the top clubs around the world. Amazing. But they're not built for that particular style of play. It's pretty obvious. And same with Jedi. Same with Anthony Robinson. You, incredible athlete, fantastic, can always recover on defense and is a pain in the ass, can do darting runs up the sideline and do some blind crosses into the box and be effective at it. And I'm not surprised that he's effective in the Premier League, where that is the primary way of playing soccer in England. It's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, run all over the place. It would be different in Spain, right? Especially certain clubs in Spain, where it's not back and forth, athleticism all over the place. It is more technical. It is more tactical. It is more possession oriented. Jedi Robinson would not look the same in La Liga versus the Premier League. And if you want to build a possession base, it's not the perfect profile. Would you rather have Marcelo as a left back in a possession based team or Anthony Robinson? I mean, that's a good litmus test for folks out there.
Yeah, that makes sense, Gary. Like you said, football is losing its class a little bit, huh?
It's been losing its class for a while, Ben. And a lot of the top footballers historically have said it over and over and over again. Don't take it from me. All right.
All right, brother.
Cool. One of these days, we'll have to have a full Weston McKennie episode.
We can invite any, the guy who sent that screenshot, dude. I was fucking laughing when I saw that early Thursday.
These people are just fans, Ben. These people are just fans of like soccer, right? And you see what NFL fans do and NBA fans do, and they like shit talking and trying to dunk one person or another. It's like, they're not practitioners, Ben. They have no expertise.
Yeah. And like you said, Gary, I think it was during the time of the fires, like whenever something's relevant, everybody becomes an expert at it. So like, oh, all of a sudden, Weston McKennie's the captain of Juventus. I know, I've seen every single Weston McKennie game before. Man, get the fuck out of here, dude. Come on.
No, everybody's an expert right away. And yeah, man, folks are so deprived in their own lives, I think, that they try to get their rocks off somehow, some way. I don't think a person who is truly satisfied in their life, in their profession, whatever it happens to be, spends their time, you know, throwing darts and trying to do gotchas, you know, on X or on Instagram, or like folks who are in the comments many times now, because my girl now is following this whole Blake Lively, Ryan Reynolds saga. I don't know if you know anything about that or whatever, but I hear about it all the time. And she starts reading the comments, you know, of certain influencers. I'm like, why are you reading the comments? Why do you understand who's writing in the comments here? Like, my God, dude. Luckily, we have folks in our comments who are asking questions, who want to learn clearly, who have a vested interest through their kids, or maybe they're a coach that have a vested interest in their profession, that are looking for points of view that aren't in the mainstream. So I'm definitely differentiating them from the folks that I'm making fun of. You know, the folks that I'm making fun of, I think they're wasting their lives, are the ones like, minute 343, you were wrong. You said that Weston McKinney sucks. Ha ha. You know what I mean? That's a moron right there.
Yeah.
We have to ignore the trolls, dude. The trolls should not get any of the attention.
That's true. I just find it fucking amazing just because I know you so well, but fucking hilarious. Well,
Ben, and like, who am I? I'm a little tadpole. You know what I'm saying? I'm nothing. Just look at the shit that Elon has to put up with. Look at it. It's like, and the guy's doing incredible work. The guy fucking lands 30-story tall buildings, you know, and catches them with fucking two arms on a tower from space. And people call him a moron, an idiot, a fraud. He knows nothing about science or engineering. He's just a fucking charlatan. Like, I don't know. I have no words, Ben. It leaves you speechless to see millions of people talking shit about remarkable practitioners.
No, dude, people hate to see other people succeed when it's not them, you know? It's like everybody just wants to, if you haven't found your own success, you're so quick to just put other people down when they're having any type of, you know, good fortune or success. It's like, come on, why can't we just build each other up and fucking continue to advance civilization? But like, that's, you said, game. Gary, the pioneers, if it wasn't for them, I mean, we'd still be in caves. That,
Ben, the pioneers are always the first to get shot at. Always, Ben. It's just a fact of life. So be it. I'm down for it, Ben. Let's go.
You'll take a bullet, G, to the ear.
Bro, that was fake, dude. That was totally fake. He is like World Wrestling Federation. He just fell and then, you know, a little cut his ear with a little blade or something, you know?
He's a preppin' now.
Telling you, Benny, this is insane. Yeah. All right, dude. Let's wrap this one up. I don't think we answered everything there. There's a lot of other things. So maybe we can just reconvene and do another one this Wednesday if folks liked this one.
Right. Yeah, I think we touched on a lot of good points, man. But for sure, and even probably in this episode, people are going to still have questions and, you know, shoot them our way.
Which is great, man. Hey, let me know if you want me to write a book. I'm thinking about it.
You got my vote, Gary.
All right, Ben. This is a good one, dude.
All right, brother. Sounds good. Later, man.
Later, Ben. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches. You can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.